Rick Ganley, this is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. By the end of this month, U.S. trade officials hope to have one new trade agreement in hand to get another back on track. The first is known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, involving the United States and 11 other Pacific nations, as varied as Malaysia, Chile, Japan, and Canada. It aims to lower tariffs and ease investment restrictions among them, with a nod to labor rights and environmental protection. The second effort is focused across our other ocean, a transatlantic deal to liberalize trade with Europe. And as both these efforts kick into higher gear, those involved can take with them lessons learned from another huge trade agreement that turns 20 this month, the largest geographically at the time, NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. It was signed by President Bill Clinton in December 1993 and deeply linked the American economy with Canada and Mexico. Back then, there were passionate predictions about what this would mean for our own economy, from rosy forecasts for enduring prosperity to Ross Perot's famous giant sucking sound of American jobs going to Mexico. Today in The Exchange, two decades of NAFTA, its impact today, and how it did and did not live up to expectations. Let's hear from you. What do you think NAFTA's meant for our economy? Has it helped or hurt overall? And does it still even matter, given the economic ascendance today of China, Brazil, India, and others? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have two guests with us. Rick McIntyre is joining us by phone. He's a professor of economics and political science at the University of Rhode Island. He's also author of the book, Our Worker Rights, Human Rights. And Rick McIntyre, really nice to have you. Thanks for your time.
Good morning.
And joining us again from Hanover is Matt Slaughter, economics professor at Dartmouth College, associate dean of the MBA program at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business. Matt is also faculty director at the Center for Global Business and Government. And Matt, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you, Laura. Pleasure to be here.
Well, and Matt, let's just roll the clock back 20 years, if we could, for a few minutes. How big a deal was this trade agreement back in the early 90s when the first President Bush and then President Clinton after him were promoting it?
It was a very big deal. I think people forget, given all that's happened in the global economy in the past 20 years, just how important a trade agreement with Mexico in particular was at the time. So go back to 1992 and 1993. India, China, Brazil, a lot of these countries we hear about in recent years, economically, they were largely on the moon at that time. Their entry into the world economy had just barely begun. Mexico was, in the eyes of many business leaders, many policymakers, many workers, the main dimension of low-income, high population countries around the world. And so at the time, we already had a free trade agreement with Canada that was signed in 1988. What was very contentious was the concern about extending that trade agreement to Mexico and what that might bring for American workers and American businesses.
Yeah, and why was it so contentious, Matt?
A lot of people worried, per your Ross Perot quote, that this agreement would destroy the manufacturing sector of the United States in particular. There were these grave predictions that the relatively low wages in Mexico would lead every manufacturing job and every manufacturing worker to migrate down to Mexico. So there was a real concern that the low wages of Mexico would be a competitive edge that would be somehow unfair.
And the economic promise of NAFTA, and Rick, I want to go to you in just a second, too. But, Matt, on the upside, there was this promise that, you know, this rising tide would lift all boats, right? I mean, that was the hope.
That was definitely the hope. And I think after 20 years, one of the things we've learned about NAFTA was some of its opponents and also some of its proponents oversold the claims about the impacts of NAFTA. Trade agreements are largely about raising average standards of living, and that clearly happened in the United States and in Mexico and in Canada. There's a number of academic studies that have shown that. But those benefits overall come through what economists and policymakers oftentimes call creative destruction. And so were there some jobs destroyed by NAFTA in the United States? Yes, absolutely. That definitely happened. But at the same time, other jobs were created in other companies, in other industries, in other parts of the country the net benefits of more trade and investment among the three countries have been clear. But there was some cost and dislocation along the way as well.
Yeah, and Rick, I'd love your thoughts, too. You know, again, going back 20 years, some of the conversation, the debate around this, I mean, we forget. This was a huge, huge deal.
Well, it was very heated, and those of us who have a little gray in our hair probably remember the debate between Al Gore and Ross Perot, which was a very interesting exchange and very memorable and unique. I mean, we don't get that kind of debate on national television on these issues too often. I think I agree with much of what Matt said, but I think we have to look now at NAFTA and also the formation of the World Trade Organization, which happened the next year, as marking really a dramatic change both in international and domestic politics, because although NAFTA was originally negotiated under the first Bush administration, it was also promoted by President Clinton. And Clinton famously was engaged in this so-called political triangulation in which he placed himself between the Democrats and the Republicans. And it was really a shift to have a Democratic president promoting a trade agreement which was absolutely opposed by organized labor. That was a big change in our politics. And organized labor has really been out in the cold ever since with nowhere to go as both parties have supported these kinds of trade agreements.
Yeah, lots of Democrats upset with Clinton over this. Right, go ahead.
Well, some Democrats were, and some Democrats supported him. You see the same thing with Obama, who ran in 2008 arguing that we ought to renegotiate NAFTA, and now he's promoting this so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership. Internationally, this was the beginning of a series of agreements that dealt not only with trade, but a whole range of economic governance issues, including investment, intellectual property rights, government procurement, so that these are called trade agreements, but they're actually much broader than that, and that's not well understood by the public. So NAFTA was the first of these broad-ranging agreements that really reduce the sovereignty of national governments.
That's been the concern on one side, right, Rick? I have read that trade agreements sometimes get hit from the left over concerns about the environment and worker rights, and from the right about this national sovereignty issue and whether these big trade agreements take away from national sovereignty. Is that how you see some of the political opposition to these trade agreements, starting off with NAFTA, Rick?
Well, you know, the NAFTA debate became about jobs. And, you know, we don't really have good ways to measure the impact of trade agreements on employment. Our standard trade models that we teach to undergraduates don't even incorporate the possibility of loss of employment. And the econometric models have to make assumptions that really are unrealistic. So the whole jobs discussion was probably misleading. I mean, maybe there was a sucking sound, but it was pretty small. And you have to remember at that time, the economy of Mexico was about the size of the economy of Los Angeles. So the United States is this gigantic economy, making an agreement with this little tiny economy to the south. So people get fearful about jobs, and I think that's really why the focus is so much on employment, and for some parts of the country, including where I live and including where you live, we have been exposed to trade and we have lost employment. But sometimes what gets lost is these other issues of investment, government procurement, intellectual property rights that are also very important.
Let me also invite our listeners to join us. And then, Matt, I want to bring you back in. Our number here on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, we're looking back at 20 years of the North American Free Trade Agreement and how it might inform our conversations about new upcoming trade agreements. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. What do you think NAFTA has meant for our own economy here in this country? Has it helped? Has it hurt? And does NAFTA even still matter, given that the economic world has changed, as Matt Slaughter pointed out earlier? Again, we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And Matt, I'd love your thoughts, too, on what Rick said. I mean, the debate back then was really about job loss. And Rick's right. It's a lot more complicated than that, intellectual property, investment, and so forth. But on the jobs, Rick said, you know, we don't have a good way of measuring job loss from these trade agreements, especially in NAFTA. Why is that? I mean, if it's all about jobs, shouldn't we be able to measure it somehow?
So that's a great question, Laura. I think in a basic sense, one of the challenges is research in economics is not like research in a laboratory for biology or chemistry. So what ideally we'd love to be able to do to answer that question precisely is rerun the past 20 years of history without the NAFTA and see how jobs and incomes and industries evolved in the three countries and compare with what actually happened. So Rick's insight there, I think, is well taken. The other point I'll echo is the policy debate, I think, very quickly moved to an area where there's a lot of research, despite the limitations Rick cites, that has shown for lots of countries over lots of periods, trade and globalization more generally is not so much about the number of jobs, it's about the kinds of jobs. And what many of the supporters of NAFTA were seeking, and what I think the research has shown clearly, is that NAFTA was going to integrate more closely the companies and the labor markets of Canada, the United States, and Mexico. So automobiles is a good example. The automobile industry of the big three automakers in particular based in the U.S., of Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler, today they have very integrated operations across Canada, the United States, and Mexico, where different components are assembled and produced in different geographies, and they move around on railroad cars and trucks so that these companies can most efficiently produce the cars and trucks and minivans that they sell in our three countries and around the world.
So in terms of the industries that were winners and losers, and I know reporters always try and make it easy that way, but Matt, the auto industry was a big winner from this. In one sense, lots of those jobs went to Mexico, though. So from a worker sense, maybe it's not so great.
Well, so that's the essential challenge of what is sometimes called the political economy of trade and globalization more generally. There's both winners and losers at the same time. And I think the policy conversation ideally focuses more on what are the aggregate benefits? Are they, how large are they? And then to the extent that there are winners and losers, how do the people harmed by these forces of the global economy, how can they be supported and hopefully benefit in the future?
All right, coming up, we'll pick up on that point with both of you and also get a uniquely New Hampshire take on that question. Winners, losers, job loss, and so forth. We'll also take your calls, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. This week, writers on a New England stage welcomes Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. She'll be reading from her latest book, The Bully Pulpit, and speaking with NHPR's Virginia Prescott about researching the book. Join us at the Music Hall in Portsmouth tomorrow evening. Tickets and information are at themusichall.org, sponsored in part by TransCanada Corporation. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from the UNH Graduate School, preparing leaders for the 21st century, now hosting information sessions in Durham and Manchester, unh.edu. From Vineyard Brands, importers of Livia FM wines, from Fami Perrin of the Southern Rhone Valley, available at New Hampshire State Liquor Stores, lovefm.com. And from Ellen's Interiors, New London in Cambridge, Massachusetts, offering Holt Cutter Lighting, lighting to accommodate natural physical changes of the aging eye. Ellen'sInteriors.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the North American Free Trade Agreement, which turns 20 this month. What's your take on this historic trade deal that, as we've been hearing from our guests, was enormously important 20 years ago and still has an impact today? Our phone number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. All one word. We're going to take a few minutes now and look at the debate over NAFTA as it's unfolded here in New Hampshire. Joining us now with more on that is Brian Walston. He's NHPR's digital reporter. His report on NAFTA in the Granite State is available online, nhpr.org. And Brian, thanks for taking some time out for us this morning.
Morning, Laura.
Well, you wrote in your article, Brian, that as the 20-year anniversary of NAFTA approaches, the debate is still going strong. We've gotten a little bit of that from our other guests. What's at the core of that debate, Brian, here in the Granite State?
Well, sure, Laura. I mean, Matt and Rick touched on a lot of this already. I mean, on the pro side, there's been a huge increase in trade, and that's exports and imports, but especially in exports, especially exports of New Hampshire products to Mexico. I mean, in the early 90s, about $50 million in New Hampshire products were sold each year to Mexico. By 2012, that figure was $474 million, which is, I think, about a 900% increase.
Wow, that's giant.
Yeah, and it's about 14% of all the New Hampshire exports in total. So, you know, that's meant jobs. I mean, by one estimate, about 23,000 jobs. On the other side, there's a recognition that NAFTA and trade agreements in general have, you know, cost an awful lot of good jobs here in New Hampshire, and those jobs aren't coming back. And that's had a ripple effect on the middle class, lowering wages for many workers and lowering the standard of living for many families.
What were some of the industries that were most affected, Brian? We talked earlier about, you know, the car industry. Later on, we might talk about agriculture in terms of the United States economy. But here in New Hampshire, what kinds of businesses were most affected by NAFTA?
Well, I think it's generally electronics companies, auto parts especially, computer components, things like that. Also, I mean, I was kind of surprised to know that New Hampshire used to have a pretty solid, what they called jacquard weaving. It's fancy weaving. They had about a handful of good companies here that produce these labels, woven labels.
And, for clothing, right?
Right. And, you know, one of the folks that I talked to had a company. He supported NAFTA at the beginning. After a couple of years, he had to lay off about a third of his workers. He tried to survive by even contracting some of his work out of the country to countries and workers that were actually hurting his business. But by 2003, I think he had to close his business. And he told me there were about five companies in New Hampshire that did the same type of work, and they're gone too. So textile and clothing have been hurt as well. And someone once told me it's not that different than what happened in the middle of the 20th century when a lot of New England textile mills moved their production south, where their labor costs were cheaper.
And this label manufacturer, I mean, he wasn't some sort of, you know, who knows what operation. He was doing labels for, you know, what,
oh,
Ralph,
sure.
Lauren,
Ralph Lauren,
Brooks
the Gap,
Brothers, and I mean,
Disney,
he's a big deal.
JCPenney, yeah, he had what he called a wonderful company. And at one point he was, I think, employing about 55 people, cut it by a third, and was down to 13. He had three shifts going at one point and down to one, and then he just couldn't sustain it anymore.
Is the displacement that you found, Brian, all about factories going to Mexico where labor's a lot cheaper, or later on, you know, China or Malaysia or wherever, or were there other factors weighing in there?
Well, you know, a lot of companies, their customers will move their production to other places. And so, you know, that hurts them as well. And, you know, if companies start in using imports from other countries and that hurts them, you know, they can't sustain their business. So,
you know, you and others, Brian, have mentioned, and we'll talk with our guests as we move on this hour, about other trade agreements that came after NAFTA, especially the WTO, the World Trade Organization, and how that's been a game changer. Among the New Hampshire people you talked to, Brian, about NAFTA, what did they say about the stuff that came later, especially the World Trade Organization, especially as we look back at 20 years of NAFTA? I mean, I guess what I'm trying to get at is NAFTA such a big deal anymore, given that we have these other bigger trade arrangements?
Well, invariably, when I mentioned NAFTA to people, they would, especially critics of it, would say, well, it's no longer about NAFTA. We're talking about, you know, in the textile gentleman that I talked to, he said NAFTA was only the beginning of the end. The WTO, China's emergence as a big trading partner in the United States, was the end. And, you know, they're now saying it's no longer NAFTA. It's these, what Rick mentioned, these broad-ranging agreements with other countries, South Korea, Colombia, Panama. And, of course, they worry about, you know, new agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the impact that they will have on jobs in this country.
You know, it was real interesting to hear our other guests, Rick McIntyre and Matt Slaughter, say how hard it is to measure the job impact. And as you know, Brian, when NAFTA was being debated 20 years ago, it was all about what will happen to the jobs. Will they come to the United States? Will they go to Mexico or Canada? You tried to untangle this for New Hampshire. How hard was it?
Well, there are some measures. I mean, the Economic Policy Institute, they've done a lot of work on this. They come at it from a certain perspective. They said that there were some more than 25,000 manufacturing jobs have been lost since 1994. And But most of that is actually, they tracked it since 2001. So a lot of it has to be attributed to the WTO to the extent that the recession didn't have an impact.
Yeah, there was a recession at that time, and then the latest recession. Yeah, go
but
ahead,
Brian. There's a program called the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program that's administered by the Department of Labor. Companies, workers, trade unions, even the state can apply for certification under these when companies start laying off workers. By one analysis, about 114 companies were certified as trade-impacted workplaces between 1994 and 2009, and those companies either shifted production to Mexico or other countries, or they were forced to close due to increase in imports. Now, and those 114 companies, according to this analysis, laid off almost 11,000 workers. Now, since 2009, according to the state New Hampshire Department of Employment Security, probably another 4,700 workers have been laid off due to trade agreements.
And again, that's the federal government saying, yes, we certify that these jobs were lost because of disruption from trade.
Correct.
All right. Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Brian Walston. Again, he's NHPR's digital reporter. If you want to learn more about his report on NAFTA and its impact on the Granite State, go to our website, nhpr.org. You can join us now with a question or comment, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And Rick McIntyre, Matt Slaughter, let's go to our listeners now. Diane's calling in from Portsmouth. Hi, Diane. You're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, Laura. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was interested in comments by the folks who are there and about the interrelationship between immigration and NAFTA. And I know we've lost jobs to Mexico, but we still have an issue of people coming across the border looking for work. So where's the balance there? What is going on in terms of people leaving Mexico to come here looking for work when all of these jobs are going there?
Oh, it's a great question, Diane. Thank you. Rick McIntyre, you first.
Well, the reason that so many Mexican folks have come to the United States over the last couple of decades, the main reason is the impact of NAFTA on agriculture in Mexico. That Mexican peasants who are small landowners, own small plots, simply couldn't compete with American agribusiness. And so they literally started walking across the border into the United States. When NAFTA was signed, there were very, very few Mexican people in the city of Providence. Now there's a large Mexican community here. So that's one area where there's a direct impact of NAFTA on what we see today. Now, the thing that often gets lost in these agreements is the distributional effects, so that the negative impacts in both the United States and in Mexico tended to fall on lower-income people. And that's clearly the case in Mexico, and that's what drove folks across the border. Now, since the economic crisis of 2008, things have changed a little bit. The United States is not exactly a place that where the economy is humming, and Mexican immigration has slowed quite a bit. But if you think of Mexico now as sort of the 51st state, which it is economically, it's not surprising that in the years leading up to 2008, people who lost their livelihoods in agriculture in Mexico began to move to the U.S.
So small farmers in Mexico, Rick, really didn't do so well in this deal, and that's why they came to the United States in such big numbers?
They took it on the chin. And now, NAFTA is an unusual agreement relative to the European situation in that it allows for the free flow of capital, it allows for the free flow of goods. It does not allow for the free flow of people. So it's not surprising that if you link these two economies, you're going to get an increase in people movement. The fact that it was mostly peasants, small farmers, is directly attributable to the effects of NAFTA.
Now, and Matt, I want you in on this too, but Rick, so another question. We talked earlier about how because of NAFTA, some U.S. manufacturers shifted production to Mexico. Why didn't these farmers go to factories located within Mexico instead of coming across the border and dealing with all the immigration hassles and fear of being illegal and so forth?
Well, some of them did. I mean, some of them were able to move to the northern border states or to the area that's a little farther south which is the auto center, and find employment. So it's not like every single person who was displaced in agriculture ended up in the U.S., but quite a few did. The employment gains in Mexico, which are real, were not sufficient to absorb that entire surplus population.
Got it. Matt, love your thoughts, too, on Diane's question, how NAFTA affected the immigration we see in this country. Diane, thank you for calling. Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, it's a great question that Diane asks. The other thing to keep in mind, in addition to the insight Rick shared about some of the agricultural impacts of NAFTA in Mexico, is part of the immigration pull into the United States at that time was the boom the U.S. economy was experiencing. Go back 20 years, and in the post-crisis world today, we kind of forget. The late 1990s was a period of tremendous economic growth and job growth and income growth in the United States. So a big force that was pulling immigrants into the United States from Mexico, but other countries as well, was how strong our labor market was. A lot of people came into construction, into agriculture, into a lot of industries in the United States. And if we think about the reasons that NAFTA was negotiated, an overarching goal for the leaders of all three countries is actually to try to have the integration of trade and investment be a force that might mitigate some of the pressures on immigration that had been present for some time. And as Rick rightly pointed out, in recent years, with a sharp downturn in the U.S. economy and the U.S. labor market, net immigration to the United States from Mexico has fallen to nearly zero.
You know, we heard earlier from Brian Walston again, who looked at that report on NAFTA here in New Hampshire. What about winners and losers nationally, Matt Slaughter? So is it safe to say that manufacturing workers, now from the workers' perspective, manufacturing workers did see job loss? I have read that American agribusiness had a net win with NAFTA. What do you think? Is that too simple? Winners and losers, Matt.
No, I thought Brian's report shared a lot of great insight on the reality of these distributional issues. So I jotted down some of the interesting numbers that he shared. Since 2001, there's estimates that about 25,000 jobs in New Hampshire in manufacturing were lost. That resonates with the aggregate U.S.-wide manufacturing job loss. Since 2000, the U.S. economy in total has lost over 5 million manufacturing jobs. Now, at the same time, a lot of manufacturing jobs were created, as were a lot of jobs and services, despite that net job loss. So one of the things that Brian's report underscores, I think, is the dynamism of growth in the U.S. economy that comes from NAFTA, but that also comes from other forces as well. And I think one statistic that's really important to keep in mind when talking about these important issues of distributional gains is every hour that the U.S. economy is open for business, about 25,000 jobs are destroyed. At the same time, every hour, about 25,000 jobs are created. So each month in the U.S. economy, there's about 4 million jobs both created and destroyed at the same time.
Wow, that's a lot.
It is a lot. And I think it speaks to one of the insights that Brian shared, which is this program called Trade Adjustment Assistance is a program that was created with good intentions, actually in the early 1960s, as part of trade negotiations in the predecessor to the WTO called the GATT. But a lot of the policies and practices that we have under TAA today are really outdated, both in terms of how they're designed and in terms of the magnitude of overall federal support, I think, that's provided to workers. The dynamism of the U.S. labor market today, I think, speaks to the need for a more expansive and a more robust social safety net.
Let's take another call if we could. Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. We're taking your questions, comments, thoughts about the North American Free Trade Agreement, which turns 20 this month. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Steve's been waiting in Keene. Hi, Steve. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. I had a little cold here. I'd like to talk about this free trade NAFTA and its children and the lack of accountability with environmental regulations and safety regulations. We hear of horrific fires in overseas production plants, building collapses, workers dying. And I just would like some... I would like an answer as to why we would accept these costs to these people, but also to what has happened to our own working class in this country. Americans love to compete. We're competitive people, but we can't compete in countries that do not have decent environmental and workplace safety standards, that don't have horrific work conditions. And for me, the free trade movement has given capital a permanent upper hand over labor. And would you please elaborate?
Sure, Steve, thanks a lot for the question. And boy, Rick, back in the day when this is being debated, labor rights on both sides of the borders were hugely debated. Go ahead, and thanks again, Steve, for the call.
Well, I mean, the caller has a point. These are elite-driven agreements. The working people didn't sit down 20 years ago and think, wow, let's have free trade with Mexico. These are agreements that are driven by corporate folks, who want to increase profits. I mean, that is really what's behind all of these agreements. And in terms of labor standards, just to take NAFTA for a second before talking about what the caller was asking about, there was a side agreement in NAFTA that President Clinton promoted, and it established a dispute resolution format in terms of labor standards, but it really left the enforcement of labor standards up to the individual countries, and the board that adjudicates labor disputes really has no enforcement ability whatsoever. Now, that's by design, okay? In NAFTA and also in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, there's very nice language about labor standards, about workers' rights to associate freely, to bargain collectively, but there's no enforcement. So what's happened over time, and this started with Clinton, is that because of some political pressure in the United States, labor standards are increasingly mentioned, talked about in these agreements, but without any enforcement mechanism that has any teeth. So I think the caller is, in fact, correct about this.
So that's one of the fallouts from NAFTA, Rick, is that politicians promoting these agreements at least talk about labor rights. Whether they're enforced is another story?
Well, it is. And 10 years ago, there was a big debate about whether labor standards should be included in trade agreements or not. And the International Labor Organization wanted it. The World Trade Organization did not. That was a big debate. Now, if you look at our recent bilateral agreements with Korea, with Panama, with Colombia, labor standards are in all these agreements.
Okay,
and
Rick,
I'm going to cut you off there, Rick.
I apologize. We will pick up on that after a super short break, so keep it right here.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the growing sophistication of targeted online ads. Then for this month's Environmental Outlook, U.S. ethanol policy and what's ahead for advanced biofuels. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Kimball Union Academy, a boarding and day school for students in grades 9 to 12 near Dartmouth College in Meriden, New Hampshire, and Environment Design for Learning, KUA.org. And the Colonial Theater in Keene presenting the New York Theater Ballet performing The Nutcracker this Saturday, December 7th. Tickets and information at thecolonial.org. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, the two New Hampshires will examine the divide between rural and urban, economic and demographic, and some ideas about how to bridge the gap. Email us your thoughts before the show at exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word, and then join us tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today in The Exchange, we're looking back 20 years at the North American Free Trade Agreement. President Bill Clinton signed it 20 years ago this month. We're looking at what NAFTA has meant for our own economy here in the United States and in New Hampshire. Join us with your comments, questions, thoughts, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Rick McIntyre, sorry I had to cut you off there before the break. Again, you were saying that as a result of NAFTA, politicians at least make mention of worker rights, but how strong those rights are is still up in the air. Go ahead and finish that up, Rick, if you could, please.
Well, there's simply no enforcement mechanism. And you know, this is by design. If you look at the negotiations over the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the U.S. is the only one of those countries that even wants to talk about labor standards. But we talk about labor standards for domestic political consumption, not because there's all that much interest amongst elite groups in putting real enforceable standards into these agreements. In the poorer countries, they see exploitable labor as their comparative advantage, and they don't want these things in these agreements at all. So we haven't moved very far. We've moved from not wanting to talk about it to talking about it but not doing anything.
Wow. What do you think, Matt? Talk of labor standards is just for domestic political consumption. We're not serious.
I'll offer a slightly different view on that. Steve raises a couple of really important issues in the question that he asked. History shows quite clearly that moderate and poor income and poor countries, they tend to have different and oftentimes lower, in the commonly defined ways, labor standards and environmental standards than other countries. That was true if you look at the United States generations or 100-200 years ago. As incomes rise in those countries, citizens and policymakers tend to change quite dramatically what sorts of environment they want to have, both for clean air, for working conditions. And I think that engagement in the world economy by countries like Mexico through NAFTA, more recently China joining the World Trade Organization, that's actually a positive force to help increase the standards for the environment and labor in those countries. It's not a magic bullet by any means. And that's because these agreements are touching on deep issues of national sovereignty and policymaking behind the borders of these countries. And so NAFTA was really one of the first agreements to go beyond just what are sometimes called these border barriers of trade taxes and import quotas to think about how the countries involved might try to have some common agreement and adjudication procedures for issues that affect all countries of labor, the environment, and other deeper policy issues.
And we're moving into an area where I wanted to go with you gentlemen, sort of how NAFTA informs discussion about these new agreements that are being debated right now, the Pacific one and the Atlantic one. But Matt Slaughter, one more very quick question for you, please, on NAFTA itself. We've talked a lot this hour about the focus on Mexico, the impact on farmers there, the impact on manufacturing here. What about Canada, Matt? I mean, that's a big trading partner for New Hampshire. Its economy seems to be doing pretty well, thanks to NAFTA. Matt, what do you think?
Oh, great point, Laura. Canada has benefited from NAFTA, like the United States and Mexico has. That's true for the country overall. Like for Mexico and the United States, as we've been discussing, there have been winners and losers in Canada as well. What's interesting in the policy process is, from the U.S. perspective, I'll remind listeners, the United States and Canada signed a free trade agreement in 1988, and that caused very little conversation in the United States at that time. It was actually a very contentious issue in Canada at the time.
Really? Why?
Well, they were very concerned, many policymakers, workers, and companies, about how the Canadian economy would fare in the wake of this integration with such a large global leading economy as the United States. So in Canada, there was a lot of policy concern in 1988. In the United States, there was very little policy conversation. And I think the contrast between what was called the Canadian-U.S. Free Trade Agreement and a few years later Mexico joining is precisely this issue we've been discussing of Mexico is a relatively low-wage country. Canada, in many ways, is like the United States. It's another advanced country in terms of its economic structure and policymaking.
How do you think they're observing this 20-year anniversary or birthday, Rick McIntyre, in Canada?
Well, I think Matt is correct on this, that for the most part, NAFTA has worked fairly well for Canada. But that's a model of how trade agreements can be beneficial when you have two countries that have relatively similar labor environmental standards. They're culturally similar. It tends to be easier. This is why the gains in Europe during the early days of the European Union were so clear, that you were integrating countries that don't have these vast differences in culture, economy, and politics. So for Canada, you know, the Canadians are always worried about the big monster to the south. They're worried about preserving their culture. There were and are concerns, but on the whole, I think that NAFTA has worked out for the most part, pretty well for the Canadians.
Again, our number for you to join us with your questions or comments as we look back at 20 years of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And gentlemen, here's an email that came in earlier from Dale in New Hampton. He says, interesting show. He says, my question, what impact has NAFTA had on the expansion of manufacturing in China? It's a good question, and it gets to, Matt Slaughter, this idea that you presented earlier, that the economic world has changed since the early 90s. Go ahead, Matt, on that question, please.
That's a great question from Dale. I think policymakers in China looked at the NAFTA and realized China could realize similar benefits if it engaged the rest of the world in similar trade and investment agreements. So NAFTA was an impetus to some policymakers in China that led to their joining the World Trade Organization in 2001. And the impact of that on the global economy has been at least as dramatic as NAFTA has been. No disrespect to the good people of Mexico, but China is so much larger. Its labor force is an order of magnitude larger than that of Mexico. And so I think the interesting issue that Dale's question raises is a lot of people, in thinking about the impact of the NAFTA on the U.S. and Mexico, had not foreseen how dramatically China would integrate into the world economy.
Right. And, you know, two decades after this treaty was signed, as you said earlier, Matt, the global economy has changed. China's an economic superpower. Japan is no longer the robust competitor that it was. Brazil and India and Malaysia are all steaming ahead. What do you think, Rick McIntyre, in today's global economic environment, does NAFTA even really matter that much?
Well, it matters as the precedent, and it matters in terms of the kinds of things that are now included in these agreements. One of the reasons that Mexico has been somewhat disappointed by the results of NAFTA is that they thought they were setting themselves up to be the low-wage export platform to the United States, and essentially China came along and ate their lunch.
Mm.
Now, we have some estimates of the impact of trade with China on employment in the United States, and for areas that deal in what's called soft goods, you know, textiles, luggage, hands-on assembly, and that would include both New Hampshire and Rhode Island, where I am, the results are not good. And so China, the negative impacts of the trade agreement with Mexico are increased by an order of magnitude with trade with China. And that's why, just to get back a little bit to the earlier discussion, one of the more hopeful things I see in the world is that Chinese workers are organizing and trying to improve their own conditions. And to the extent that they are successful, that's going to help people everywhere. Because while Matt is right, as countries increase their income, they want to improve their labor and environmental standards. That doesn't happen in any kind of natural process. That happens when workers get organized and they take those gains for themselves. One of the problems we face in the United States today is we no longer have the institutions that redistribute income from capital to labor, as some of the regulations, as a high minimum wage, as organized labor did in the past. So China has had a negative impact in many ways on labor conditions in the United States, but things are changing rapidly there now.
So China took away Mexico's lunch, Rick, as the place for low-wage workers. But are we seeing a shift now, perhaps back to Mexico? And what role does NAFTA play in that, if any?
Well, I mean, Matt mentioned earlier the auto industry, and it's pretty clear 40% of all auto parts that are parts of cars that are sold in the United States are now made in Mexico. Kansas City is now the number two auto-producing city in the United States after Detroit, and that's partly because there's all this stuff flying back and forth across the border with Mexico, and Kansas City is a more convenient location. So what has changed, and in retrospect, you know, you can see this is partly by design, is that nation states and borders are maybe a little bit less important than they were. And corporate supply chains are more important. And the auto industry is now organized, the North American auto industry is now organized on a three-country basis. And so what we really need to begin to think about going forward is what are the rules for environmental and labor conditions within these corporate commodity chains? And how can governments have an impact on those?
Now, that's interesting. So the auto workers have organized in Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. as sort of a three-country group, Rick. That's new.
Well,
relatively new.
The Mexican auto workers are not necessarily so affiliated with the Americans at this point. The Canadian and American auto workers have had a relationship going back a long time. And again, that's why NAFTA was such a huge gamble, because of the cultural, economic, and political differences between Mexico and the United States, which are vast. To the extent that workers can talk to each other across borders and realize that their fellow workers in the other country are not really the problem, things are better off. And that's been easier for the Americans and the Canadians to do than the Americans and the Mexicans.
You know, Matt, I'm interested in what Rick talked about, the precedent that NAFTA has set. I wonder what you think. How did NAFTA set the stage for the trade agreements that the Obama administration is talking about right now with the Pacific countries and with Europe? What do you think, Matt?
I think it set precedent in a couple of important ways. One was the breadth of NAFTA. The United States had a few earlier free trade agreements. We mentioned the one with Canada. The first was actually in 1985 with Israel. But those were relatively modest agreements, as Rick rightly pointed out, with kind of similar countries in terms of economic development. NAFTA was a real precedent in terms of the breadth and complexity of the agreement. And that's been very important, I think, for the Obama administration today with, as you said at the top of the show, Laura, with the TPP and the TTIP, as they are called. Those are much broader agreements that aim to talk about trade, to talk about investment, but to talk about a host of other issues that arise. And one that I'll mention is actually one that was touched upon by Rick. Remember, when NAFTA was signed in 1993 and went into effect starting in 1994, the internet had barely been invented. One of the things that's so different today that Rick touched upon is the spread of these global supply chains and global supply networks. So the complexity of how manufacturing happens today, how services even are manufactured today with different stages made in different countries connected through trade and investment and immigration, that's, I think, a second issue that today the Obama administration and policymakers elsewhere in the world can look back to the NAFTA and learn from in terms of thinking about new issues in business that are arising and that are relevant to companies and workers today.
So trade and investment is a host of other issues, as you said, Matt, today. I hadn't even thought about the fact that the internet wasn't really around in the early 90s. So that's a game changer, isn't it?
It really is. And so if I think about what I do as an educator, what we at Tuck and at Dartmouth can do today in education by connecting our students to students around the world, how I can connect with faculty around the world, it's fundamentally different from 20 years ago when NAFTA was the main policy issue. So what that means, for example, today with both the TTP and TTIP is a major issue is ownership and protection of intellectual property, because what's essential in a lot of these global supply networks is the ideas and the integrity of those ideas to coordinate a lot of this production across borders.
A couple emails just came in. Here's one from Dennis in Barrington who says, does NAFTA apply to Central American countries south of Mexico? If so, can they compete with China as a source of low-cost labor? Rick, can you answer Dennis's question, please?
Well, we have the so-called Caribbean Basin Initiative, which includes some Central American and Caribbean countries. China, as I mentioned earlier, China is changing, and wages are rising pretty rapidly, in at least on the eastern coast of China. But there's a story that I used to like to tell a few years ago about where baseballs were made. And baseballs used to be made in Haiti with labor paid 31 cents an hour, and then the companies moved production to Vietnam because labor there was 13 cents an hour. So it's very hard when you have this kind of wage arbitrage without the kind of institutions that we had in place at one time to raise standards. It's very hard for these countries to compete.
If you were at the table, Rick, with this Pacific agreement that's being discussed right now, or this European agreement that's a little further away, what would you tell folks? You know, look, we learned this lesson from NAFTA. Let's not do this again.
Well, the transatlantic agreement is probably not going to happen anytime soon. So let's focus on the Trans-Pacific Agreement. First of all, none of us are allowed to be at the table because this has been negotiated in secret. Even our congressional representatives have not been allowed to see the text of the agreement so far, although there are a series of corporate partners working with the U.S. International Trade Representative who have seen the agreement. So in many ways, just in the process of negotiation, this Trans-Pacific Partnership is much worse than anything we've seen in the past. And people, I think, need to educate themselves a little bit to think about what are the distributional consequences of these agreements. You know, Matt talked earlier, and I thought he made a good point about the trade adjustment assistance and the need to kind of tune that up and improve it. But, you know, the impact on disability benefits, disability payments of trade agreements is very, very large. People go on disability because they can't find jobs. So the Trans-Pacific Partnership, so far anyway, looks like it incorporates many of the negative aspects of NAFTA without necessarily incorporating many of the good ones.
Do you want to jump in there real quick, Matt Slaughter, as we close out?
It's a great question. I think policy leadership is needed. Al Gore, 20 years ago, demonstrated how leaders who articulate the trade-offs but the aggregate benefits can sway the conversation. That will be needed going forward with TPP.
All right. Well, both of you, thank you so much. Matt Slaughter, thanks again for your time. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Matt Slaughter, economics professor at Dartmouth College. And Rick McIntyre, it's great to have you. Thanks for your time.
You're welcome. Nice to be here.
Rick McIntyre, professor of economics and political science at the University of Rhode Island. Again, if you want to check out Brian Walston's piece on NAFTA in New Hampshire, that's available online at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteers are Priscilla Malcolm and John Barrett. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Canoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Canoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, New Hampshire economist and chancellor of the community college system, Ross Gatell, on his recent paper, The Two New Hampshires, What Does It Mean? Gatell looks at the major demographic and economic differences between the rural and more urban parts of our state, a divide he says is growing. We'll talk about that and his ideas on closing the gap. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 959. Good morning. The Diane Rehm Show next at 10. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Comcast Business, supporting New Hampshire Food Bank's collection of non-perishable food items at the New Hampshire for the Holidays Expo, December 7th and 8th. More at eventsnh.com. And the Woodstock Inn, Station and Brewery, all under one roof, now offering its spirited wassail ale, a winter warmer for the holidays. Information at woodstockinnbrewery.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
Good morning. It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Spending on digital advertising will total more than $40 billion this year in the U.S. Advertisers are relying less on banner ads at the top of websites to attract customers and sell products. More and more, they're placing